You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
So welcome, everyone, to this talk on Digital Echoes, Understanding Patterns of Mass Violence, Data and Statistics. I'm Elizabeth Egan with the Information Program of the Open Society Foundations. And this is Patrick Ball, who is the Executive Director of the Human Rights Data Analysis Group. Now, I hope you all had a chance to poke around and click on Patrick's resume or his bio, because it is it's quite an impressive list of places that he's done his work. But I'll just read a few lines from it. So Patrick has spent more than 20 years conducting quantitative analysis for truth commissions, non-governmental organizations, international criminal tribunals, and United Nations missions in El Salvador, Ethiopia, Guatemala, Haiti, South Africa, Chad, Sri Lanka, East Timor, Sierra Leone, South Africa, Kosovo, Liberia, Peru, Colombia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Syria. And I wanted to remind everybody the talk's going to be recorded, so just keep that in mind, but we will have a mic for questions. Patrick's going to run through a brief presentation I hear there's going to be some pedagogy. Some math. There will be some math. So you should feel free to take a break if you need and go grab some wine and cheese in that event. I'm going to go ahead and turn the floor over to Patrick Ball, and then I'll come back to the table when we're ready for questions, so please do have those lined up.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Elizabeth anticipated the trigger warning that I was going to provide. There will be algebra. There will be probability. And they will be taking data seriously. If any of those things upsets you, perhaps you should step out. Because my argument tonight will be that it matters very much that we get the answers right. And it's dangerously easy to get the answers wrong when we look at data. What I will argue tonight, through a series of examples, is that data, as it comes to us in the human rights movement, is fundamentally biased. And by bias, I do not mean that it is politically connected to one or another party to a conflict, but rather that that there is some data we are likely to get and there is other data we are unlikely to get. There are blind spots in our digital picture of the world. And I'll explain what I mean by that and provide three examples. These are only three examples. My colleagues and I, over the last 10 years, have started accumulating these examples. We now have 15 different examples. That is, every single country that we can test, we find that the raw data tell us the wrong story. Not a story that is somehow imprecise, not a story that's, well, almost good enough, but rather it tells a story that is fundamentally misleading with respect to one of the fundamental intellectual and political and historical questions that we have about that country. That is, the statistics do exactly the wrong thing. They lead us toward false certainty unless we adjust for what we don't know. I've been at this a long time. I started this work in El Salvador in 1991, building databases for human rights groups there. I was very excited at the time about what was then very new potential of using with my colleagues at the Non-Government Human Rights Commission of El Salvador, we used over 9,000 testimonies and linked those testimonies, the violence documented in those testimonies, we linked to the career structures of the officers in the Salvadoran military in order to create individualized human rights dossiers on each of the officers in the Salvadoran military. Our goal with that work was to demonstrate which officers had sufficient crimes alleged against them such that they should be obliged to retire following the agreement of the peace accords in El Salvador, and it worked. The officers that we identified as the 100 worst officers in the military were an almost exact fit to the 100 officers forced to retire by the ad hoc commission as set up by the peace process in El Salvador between the government and the FMLN. And I was hooked. But I was hooked, as I'll explain, on maybe the wrong thing. So I spent the 90s building databases for truth commissions. And while that work was very exciting and very satisfying, at the end of the 90s, in two different commissions, in South Africa and in Guatemala, I was asked by people working in the commission, hey, how many killings were there? How many people were killed in South Africa during apartheid? And I said, well, you know, we have about 6,000 here in the database. That's not the question. The question is how many people were killed? And I didn't know. So what I'm going to talk about today is how I've been answering that question for the last 15 years. And it comes down to this fundamental problem. It's an epistemological problem. It's a problem that all people face when we look out at the world. What we know is a function of who we talk to. Okay? But what we don't know is a function of who we don't talk to. And that may seem obvious, but this becomes very problematic because it may be the case that there's a systematic difference between what we do know and what we don't know. And so if we base conclusions on what we do know, we're making bad decisions. We are reaching the wrong conclusions because there's a different story that's not included in what we have. The people we didn't talk to have a different story than the people we did talk to. And it turns out that this is as true for databases as it is for qualitative researchers. In fact, I argue it's worse in quantitative work because in quantitative work, as soon as the graph hits the table, we forget that there are pieces missing from the graph. And so I'm going to open with an anecdote from work I did in the Congo with the UN in 2010. And I was in a whole series of meetings. For those of you who speak UN talk, we were protection working groups. And one of the things we had to do was try to identify contexts in which specific groups of vulnerable people were at risk so that the UN could try to do something to protect them. And I would sit in meetings with people who had worked in Congo for many years, people who spoke the local languages, had rich networks of connections and contacts with people in Congolese society, in particular areas that we were looking at. They understood the military history of the region, very important. By 2010, there had been many different militias that had come and go. They knew who the local officers in the Congolese army were. They knew who were likely to be officers who might defect and join and rejoin militias, as has happened repeatedly in Congo. They knew local leaders. They knew the civilians who were at most at risk. And we'd have a rich, engaged, thoughtful, qualitative conversation about what needed to be done, about what the risks were, about who was at risk, about what violence had happened in the last few months. And then someone would put a graph on the table. And it's like all the brains drained out of people's ears and ran across the floor. And people would say, the graph, it goes up and then it goes down. It goes up and down. And the conversation, the quality, the intellectual quality of the conversation went from a PhD seminar to Sesame Street in less than a second. And I was the only statistician in the room. And I was like, wait, this graph doesn't mean anything. Come on. This just means it went down because our staff all just went on leave. And they're not writing anything down this month. And they're like, but that's the staff that was documenting the violence by the LRA. And so we sent the report to the UN Security Council saying that LRA violence has declined. And I'm like, they went on leave. There's no decline. We have no idea if violence is up or down. And they're like, it's already been minuted in the Security Council. That's how bad this is, people. We're making global human rights policy on really, really weak data because we don't know what we don't know. Here's the problem. Let's think about it a little bit, a couple different angles. We collect and combine three databases. This is how most big human rights projects seem to work these days. People build databases in different ways, through press monitoring, through individual human rights conversations with victim communities, with other kinds of records from governments, from militaries, from police. And let's say we can combine those databases. We can merge them together. We can determine which victims are in common across multiple databases. I work almost exclusively with homicides now, and that's the easiest of all data to integrate in this way. So we now have the world as is described in these white circles. But which world do we live in? Do we live in the world here on the left, where the white circles constitute maybe a third of the reality, or do we live in the world over here on the right, where the white circles almost completely exhaust the reality that we're looking at? And the reason this is so important is not for the magnitude. I mean, that'll get the attention of the media, if you can say how many people in total have been killed, but because we probably want to compare the world on the left with the world on the right. We want to say, for example, that the Maoist guerrillas of the Sendero Luminoso have committed more or fewer killings than the Peruvian army. Which is it? Well, this is exactly, in fact, what we saw in Peru at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission there, where we had collected approximately equal numbers of documented killings attributed to Sendero Luminoso and attributed to the Peruvian army. But when we did some math, we found that Sendero Luminoso had committed many, many, many more killings than the army. And I'm going to show you that math later. not a funny joke, stay for the algebra. That's the good part, in all seriousness. It's the part that actually gets us out of the limited world of the white circles and takes us to a much more global understanding, but an understanding that is limited by the rules of probability. So let's get back to the problem. We usually don't know what we don't know. And this, the challenge that we face there is that what we don't know may, and in fact likely is, systematically different from what we do know. Uh-oh. This is true of almost all human rights data. Big data does not make this better. In fact, this problem that I'm describing is called by statisticians selection bias. It is the bias introduced into data because we got that data and we didn't get this data. And my experience of big data is that big data does not ameliorate selection bias, it amplifies it. So let me tell you why that happens. We used to, in the world of human rights, in the world before cell phones all had computers in them, if we heard about a killing, we'd report it, right? And we have the saying in our team that if a lawyer is killed at high noon in a city center, the world knows about it before dinner time. Okay? And that was true in the 1980s. That's true now. Back then, we would have gotten a few reports of it. Now we'll get hundreds, maybe thousands. But if some peasants are killed in a rural area 3 days' walk from a road, we didn't hear about it in the 80s, and we don't hear about it now. This problem has not changed, and it's not. And the reason it hasn't changed is that it's not a fundamentally technical problem. It's a problem with how information moves through different kinds of social contexts and who trusts whom to share information. If you're in a tiny rural village in eastern Congo, nothing good has ever come to your village from outside. Why would you report something horrible to outsiders who could then come and bring more bad things to your village? It just doesn't happen. So the fact that most of eastern Congo has perfectly good cell coverage now has not changed this reporting problem. So before I go much farther with all this abstraction, I want to drop into some concrete examples. I'm going to start with a discussion about what we know and what we still don't know about lethal violence in Iraq between 2003 and 2010. I'm then going to talk a little bit about how we've learned a little bit more about the scale of police killings in the United States, that is, killings committed by police officers in the United States. And I'll be commenting on a report by the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics that was presented in early March this year. And then I'll give an example of some of our very first estimates about killings in Syria. So, let's look at Iraq. Since in early 2003, a group of British researchers created a group called the Iraq Body Count. And the Iraq Body Count has done an astonishingly meticulous and careful job of collating information about violent incidents around the world, from media around the world about violent incidents that occurred in Iraq. So when people get killed in Iraq, if it turns up in the media, the people at the Iraq Body Count create a record in their database and they say, according to the sources, according to the BBC or Al Jazeera or the New York Times or Reuters or the AP or whatever their source is, we have an incident here that in which five people were killed at such and such a location on such and such a date. And if they get a different report that says 10 people were killed in the same incident, they'll merge those two reports together and put a high number on of 10 and a low number of 5, and on they go. And they can accumulate quite a few sources. Well, starting in about 2005 and 2006, colleagues of mine and I looked at that database and said, you know, we think that not all the violence in Iraq is getting covered. And in a series of discussions with the people from the Iraq Body Count, we said, stuff's not getting covered here. And they said, well, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but nevertheless, we're covering so much of it because such an intense level of international media attention is directed at violence in Iraq during this period that our data must be good enough. It's good enough to do things like assess whether or not more men or more women are being killed, or whether the victims are elderly people, adults, or children, or whether the primary perpetrators are coalition forces or al-Qaeda in Iraq. Wait, isn't there another perpetrator? No, not so much. Actually, it doesn't appear too much, so let's not worry about it. It's not in the data. Okay, now we're in 2015, and if people think a little bit about what was going on 10 years ago in Iraq, this should be making you very nervous. So let's look at the graph and see what we can learn. We looked at the data, my colleague Megan Price and I looked at the data and looked at the IBC data, and we divided it into categories by size of event. So in this bar, we represent the events that have one victim. In this bar, 2 to 5 victims. In this bar, incidents with 6 to 14 victims. And here, incidents with 15 or more victims. And then the shading on each bar represents the proportion of each set of events at each size that have a certain number of sources. So over here, events of size 1, you can see that almost all of them have 1 or 2 sources. Only 1 or 2 sources are documenting those events, and a much smaller number of events of size 1 are documented by more sources. If we can contrast that with events of 15 or more victims, we find that none of them are documented by only one source. Only a very small fraction are documented by 2 sources. In fact, most of the very large events are documented by 15 or more sources. So here's a question. How many events are there with 0 sources? That is, how many events are not documented at all? And where are they distributed across this event size? Anyone want to guess? Are there more events of size 1 or more events of size 15 and greater that have 0 sources? 1. And why would that be? Why does this give us that intuition?
Because people that can be getting killed all over a big country only notice 1 out of 10 of them get noticed.
They hardly get noticed. And the way we realize that is because if you think about how many events there are here of size 1 that only have 1 source, which is quite a few, that implies there may also be quite a few with 0 sources. But over here, almost none of them, none of them have only 1 source. Only a small number even have 2. Most of them have many sources, which indicates that these are very well documented. Maybe they're almost all covered. Maybe there aren't any events or very few events that are that large that have gone unnoticed in the world's media. Okay, this is a huge problem. Okay, because small events and large events, sorry, question?
What's the ratio of events with 1 death versus 15
deaths? Well, there's 2 ways to answer that question, and I don't know the exact answer off the top of my head for either of them, but one of the ways is what's the ratio of the number of incidents between those two. The other is what is the ratio of the number of victims between those two. In both cases, there are slightly more victims who die in events of size 1 than there are victims who die in larger events. Okay, so there's relatively few large events. Okay, it's a power law for those of you who follow that kind of thing. Yeah?
Were those independent sources, or were they potentially like a wire service reporting to 15 different newspapers and them all reporting the same thing?
Right. Did they play follow the leader? IBC reports on their website that they try not to report simple, they don't document things that are merely reprinting another story. They just try to capture the original write-up on that. So let's get back to why this is such a gigantic problem. It's a gigantic problem because small events and large events were actually 2 different conflicts happening at the same time. Okay? They're actually completely different. So let's go through all the ways they're different. First of all, the perpetrators are completely different. Right? Most of the small events are committed by Shia militias that were essentially undertaking ethnic cleansing, mostly in the Baghdad area, whereas large events were Al-Qaeda in Iraq, other insurgent groups, as well as coalition collateral damage incidents. The weapons are completely different. The small events were almost all firearms. Large events are IEDs and airstrikes or firearms in massacre contexts. Small events are, the victims are completely different. Small events are almost all adult men. These are selected, targeted killings. Large events are random selections from the population. They include women, children, elderly people, adults, and adult men, all in roughly approximately equal proportions to their proportions in the public population, the population that goes outside. And finally, the goals, as I said, are completely different. So now, as we watch the rise of ISIS, which is very much an outgrowth of ethnic cleansing, because those are Sunni groups who've been cleansed who now feel like ISIS might protect them from the Shia militias, we can start asking, wow, by overstating the importance of large events relative to small events, first thing we did is we reinforced our initial biases, right? The world was really interested in Al-Qaeda because this is part of the larger narrative from 9/11. So this is interesting. This was what we thought we were going to see. So naive statistics failed to tell us the story. They failed to provide a corrective to our prejudice and our biases. And the reason is because we didn't know what we didn't know. And what we didn't know is that there was this wildly different probability of reporting. And this is a really important idea that I want to try to express tonight, which is that imagine that an event happens in the world. What is the probability that we hear about that event? What is the probability that social knowledge is created about that event such that we actually have something we know? Well, maybe that probability varies a lot. Maybe that probability, in fact, depends on the kind of event. So the probability of a large event being reported was very high, maybe almost one, whereas the probability of a small event being reported was very small, maybe as small as 0.2. And that variability in reporting probability, we're going to see everywhere. And not only does it vary, variability in reporting probability correlates with everything we're interested in. That's why it's so devastating to our analytic capacity. Because the variation in reporting probability is connected to the kinds of things we're trying to understand. So event size, right? Something we really needed to understand, because event size is determining the way that the patterns come out on specifically the questions we're trying to ask. Like, hey, what's going on? What are the events we need to pay attention to? Yeah, except we're not seeing a whole huge fraction of them because they're hidden due to the way reporting works. So that's a big problem. I hope you're all really scared now. I hope you all feel like we don't know anything, because that's exactly the right motivation to do algebra. Because algebra is actually going to give us a really nice way to come out of this problem, okay? Algebra and a little bit of probability theory, very basic probability theory. It turns out that the way we actually do this in the real world, crazily harder than this. There are people who write entire PhD dissertations and devote their careers in mathematical statistics to this. Put your hand up. And you can talk to her, because she's done really amazing work on this stuff and terrific models that have helped us learn a lot more, particularly about the analysis we're doing in Syria. Her name is Shira Mitchell. Please talk to her later if there's time. Here's the problem, okay? We're going to look at another set of Venn diagrams. We have this circle, and statisticians by convention call a population that we're trying to look at N. That's how many people are killed, for example, by police in Texas, for example. We don't know how big N is, okay? But what we do know is that we have a list compiled by someone, and I'll talk in my next slides about some lists of police killings in the United States. We have a list with some number of people on it. We'll call that Project A. And what Project A has done is it's gone out into this space of killings by U.S. police in Texas, and it's documented some number of victims. Not all of them, but some of them. And so the first question we ask is, what's the probability that a death in this population N is documented by Project A? Okay? So this is very similar to the problem of asking, what is the probability that if I throw a coin, I've thrown a head? What is that probability? 50%. Why is it 50%? There's two possibilities, a head and a tail. We're looking for one of them, the head. Okay? And we're going to draw it once. So we're going to draw it by throwing the coin. So we've thrown the coin, and we know that we have probability 0.5. Similarly, the probability with which a death in the population N is documented by Project A is A divided by N. People follow that? Nod if that makes sense. Okay. The probability with which Project B documents a given death in N is very similar. It's B over N. And here's where it gets more interesting. Remember that we can put the two projects together and determine which of the killings are in common between the two? Okay. That's M, the part in the center, the intersection. And the probability that a death in N falls in M is the same as A and B. It's M over N. However, M is something else as well. M is the result of having been documented by A and B. And so this is like throwing two coins and asking, what's the probability I've thrown two heads? What is it? Yeah, I hear it. Go ahead and say it louder. 25%, right? It's one quarter. Why is it one quarter? It's the first probability, half, multiplied by the second probability of half. Okay? Similarly, the probability that a death is in A and B is the probability that it was in A multiplied by the probability that it was in B. So M over N is equal to A over N times B over N. Now we rearrange the terms, we multiply through by N squared, MN equals AB, we divide by M. Hey, this is really cool. We know what N is now. We didn't know N when we started, now we do. Well, at least we have an estimate of it, and I made four assumptions as I went through there, and I'm going to worry in the next slide about what those are, or at least one of them. But you guys see the power this gives us? Okay. Now we can use data that is collected by normal human rights projects, okay, projects that are not statistically oriented, but rather projects that have as their goal to write down the names of victims, to record historical memory, to clarify history, to build cases for prosecution, to do the stuff that human rights groups do, but we can also do statistics with it. We can get to an answer that corrects for what we don't know. That was the problem, right? That our data were being distorted by what we didn't know. Well, now we can correct for that. That's really powerful stuff. And it's so powerful that even government statisticians use it. That's how powerful it is. So, for some time, people in the Bureau of Justice Statistics, along with everyone paying attention in America, has been worrying about how many people have been killed by police in the United States. How many people are there? There's no list. Okay. The FBI keeps a list that they, depending on which version of their websites you look at, usually admit is a very partial list called the Supplementary Homicide Database, which is not public but is available to Bureau of Justice Statistics researchers. The Bureau of Justice Statistics keeps their own list called the Arrest-Related Deaths Database, which is a separate and independent list compiled primarily from media sources, but they have a bunch of other inputs as well. And in March this year, they published a report showing how those two databases interact. Okay? So they put the two databases together, they merged them just like I did in the previous slide, and they did the math that I showed you, N equals AB over M. Okay? Here's A, B, and M. And they came up with about 7,400 deaths for the period 2003 to 2009 and 2011, which is kind of weird. It's not really clear to me what happened in 2010, but there it is.
That number of deaths in what population?
In all of the United States in those 8 years.
Number 7,400.
Plus minus, yeah. Yeah, they didn't actually report the variance, which I think is kind of weird, but whatever. They did something much worse, so we're not going to worry too much about that piece. So here's the key piece. You remember how when I did the math in the previous slide, I said there were some assumptions? Well, let me give you a metaphor about how this logic works, and then I'll tell you what the problem is. The method we're using here is kind of as if you're facing two dark rooms. You can't see into the rooms, and for some reason you can't go into the rooms. But you'd like to know which of the rooms is larger. So you have a handful, your only tool here is a handful of small rubber balls that bounce very energetically. So you take the balls, and you throw them, the balls have a curious property, which is when they hit each other, they make a noise. So you throw the balls into the first room, and you hear. Collect the balls, go to the second room, throw them with equal force. Which room's bigger? Right. Why?
Because if it's smaller, they're going to hit off the wall and hit each other more.
Exactly. They're compressed in the first room. Okay? That's very much like what we're doing here. Okay? What we're doing here is as if we're throwing these databases into this sort of theoretical room of killings in Texas, for example, in 2006. Okay? And we're observing the databases colliding with each other. And that's the clicking. That's M. And the more collisions we hear, the smaller we think the whole universe is. But this only works if the balls are independent of each other, if they just fly around without knowing where any other balls are. What if the balls kind of like each other? As they're flying by, one ball sees the other one and says, hi, and they reach over and hit each other. They're kind of like magnetic a little bit. So they're flying around the room, but when they get close, they hit each other. What happens then? We get too many clicks, right? We get too many noises. And our inference about the size of the room is too small. That's what happened to the BJS. Okay? So the BJS estimate was too low because they failed to control for the positive correlation in the probability of reporting between the ARD database and the FBI database. Why would this be? What would create a positive correlation? What does that mean in non-statistics talk? Okay, remember that lawyer who got killed at high noon in a city center? What's the probability that he was reported in the newspaper? Very large. What was the probability that the FBI bothered to write his name down in the supplementary homicide database? Correlated, right? Because both of them are driven by some underlying notion of social visibility. Socially visible people are going to appear in both lists. Socially less visible people are unlikely to appear in either list. Okay? And so those two probabilities are correlated, which creates a positive relationship between these. And we knew this when we read that report because we've done this work in a lot of different countries, in 10 different countries, in fact. So, my colleague Christian Lum, with some very sage advice from Dr. Mitchell, spent quite a bit of time thinking about pairwise list dependence, which is the statistics talk for the magnetism between the balls. Okay? And we looked at all our old projects, projects from Kosovo, Colombia, Guatemala, Syria, and Sierra Leone, and we said, what's the distribution of correlations in these other projects? Because it turns out, if you have three or more databases with all that cool math I was telling you about earlier, we can actually calculate the magnetism. And if you can calculate those correlations, you can control for it. You can include that as part of your calculation, and you can get much better estimates. The BJS only had two lists, and as they said openly in their report and repeated when they were interviewed by 538.com, yes, there is positive correlation in these two lists, but we don't know how to control for it. And we don't know either. Okay? But what we do know is what those distributions typically look like. We know what kinds of list dependence are likely. And in fact, in particular in Colombia, we think the lists that we have for Colombia that we're using in this simulation are very much like the lists used by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So we can use the information about this magnetic attraction between the balls to correct the estimate. And what we get is not 7,400, but more like 10,000. 10,000 people killed over 8 years, 1,250 per year on average. 1,250 people killed by police on average. Oh, right, we're only including 70% of the jurisdictions in the United States. It's more than that. It's more than that. It's more than 1,250. There are about 16,000 homicides in the United States every year. At minimum, there's something like 7.8% of all the homicides in the United States are caused by police. I think it's probably closer to 10. So let's just take that and think about for a minute what it means to say that 10% of the homicides in the United States are caused by police. Three quarters of all homicides in the United States are committed by someone you know. If you're going to be a homicide victim, most probable outcome is that it's an acquaintance of some kind. So among the quarter of all homicides that remain, more than a third of them are police. If you're going to be killed by a stranger, the most probable outcome is that he's wearing a badge. Let's turn to Syria.
That's a good question. So how many police are threatened? How many police have been killed by criminals?
Very few. Very, very few. There is a really good list of those. The National Fraternal Order of Police has a website that has really excellent data on that. And you look at police killed in the line of duty, they are, I think, the 14th or 15th most dangerous profession in the United States. They're not even in the top 10. And nearly all of the police deaths that happen at work happen as a result of car accidents.
Yeah, but that can't be the case listening to police.
You answered your own question. So let's turn to Syria.
Excuse me.
Yes.
How many of those homicides that police commit do they know the person that they killed?
Fascinating question. I don't know. I don't have anything like that precision on the data. That's a fascinating question. The narratives that I generally read about doesn't seem like they know very many. But I don't know because I have a very bad sample on that. Good question. That would be really interesting to know. So from March 2011 to April 2014, in that period, we worked with a whole lot of different Syrian groups. 9 different groups. We're only going to use 4 of them for this example today. And during that period, from that period, we received the names, the dates, and locations of death for about 191,000 people killed in Syria. That's how many people we can name. Those are the people who we can, we have two valid, in machine learning talk, two valid name tokens, okay? Maybe a first name and a last name, but at least two names that are actually words of, that are name words, that aren't brother of or neighbor of or anything like that. These are actual identifying names. And a date of death precise to the day, and a location of death precise at least to the governorate, in many cases to the neighborhood. So we integrated all those databases. There's over 300,000 underlying records, but we integrate them to 191,000 individual deaths. But the question is, how many do we not know about? Of course, that's the whole theme of this talk. So we're a little bit concerned about that. And, you know, we've got a few qualifiers. I'm not going to go through them, but I'd be happy to talk about them a little bit more in detail in the Q&A. But I want us for a moment to go back to how this estimation process works. I want us to remember that we can get to an estimate, and here it has a little subscript k, and I'll tell you about that in just a second, by multiplying a and b and dividing by m, or by using a much more complicated model that's based on that same logic. Okay. The k subscript indicates that we don't make one estimate. Remember when I said that it's not so interesting to just grapple with magnitude. What's more important than magnitude is to compare different categories, often different periods, so you can get a pattern over time, or estimates for different locations, so you can see the pattern over space. Is there more in the north? Is there more violence in the north, or is there more violence in the south? Is there more violence in areas of government control, or is there more violence in areas of insurgent control? So that K, that subscript, indicates that we do it for lots of different places. Okay? And then we have a logic here, right? After we've got the estimate of N, which is, wow, how much do we know? How much do we actually know about what's going on? And the way we measure that is the rate of coverage, okay, which is the number of records we know divided by the estimate of the total number of killings that we believe to have occurred as a result of doing this math. And here's the problem. Here's what scares us a lot. Those rates change like crazy. Okay? The rate of our knowledge, the coverage rate, changes like crazy. So in this colored series of maps, the really dark sections, like this one, are places where we know 80-85% of the deaths. We've got most of the information. But the really light colored areas, in super light yellow, are areas that we may know only 10 or 15% of the deaths. Okay? And the gray areas are places where our information isn't sufficient to make an estimate. So look at the variation across there. Watch, sometimes we can't make an estimate at all. Sometimes we've got almost all the data. Then the data gets worse. Then it gets worse. Then it gets really, really, really bad. Then it gets really good. Up and down, up and down.
This is over time.
These are over time, right? These are months. Each one represents a month between...
we can't see the headings.
Though. Sorry about that. July 2012 through June 2013. Okay? So each map is a single month. Look at how much variation there is in our knowledge. In our knowledge. You can imagine, I hope, looking at this, how distorted our conclusion would be if we drew conclusions from the raw data. Because the raw data are just an artifact of the reporting process. Any trend we would see completely dominated by the variation in our knowledge over time and space. Worse, there's no pattern here. There's no pattern. We can't predict that there's going to be a certain amount of coverage without doing the math that we showed in the previous slides. We're stuck. So I just want to warn again, we should never be drawing important conclusions on the basis of raw observed data. Raw observed data is not a good foundation for an important conclusion. Let me show you one more about how bad it is. Okay? So here what we're doing in this graph is the purple regions indicate cases that we've documented by 4 sources, 3 sources, 2 sources, 1 source, and then the light blue are the total that we estimate as having not been documented at all. Now, this is Hama between December 2012 and March 2013. And I want you in your head to draw a line across the tops of the purple. That's the observed data. And look how nicely it goes down. Wow, it's really great. Things are getting better. Uh-huh. That's great. Getting better. No, they're not getting better. There's a giant spike in January 2013 that's completely unobserved. Giant spike there. Huge number of killings, not documented at all. What happened? Well, we went back to the newspaper and found that in January 2013, Syrian government took control of Hama, and they held it until February 2013, when the insurgents took it back. So what this is really telling us about is, you know, the documentation groups, the human rights groups' capacity to document. That's what's really happening here. You know, when the government's in charge, they have a really hard time documenting very much. Whereas when the insurgents are in charge, they have a much easier time documenting things. Right? So it looks in some ways, if you look at raw data for Syria, it looks like things are equally bad between the government and the insurgents. This graph suggests it's not. That's not true at all.
But how do you know that there was a spike in deaths if they were undocumented?
That. We do the estimates. We do the estimates for each period, right? The point of the estimation is specifically that, to figure out how many are undocumented. Okay? So it's precisely by, not exactly this equation, but this logic, that we get to that estimate. Okay? It's back to the balls. If you imagine the balls bouncing around in that room, okay? In 1 month we hear, and the next month we hear, okay? And we're like, holy cow, what's going on the next month? Nothing's clicking. There's so much more room in that. That room is so much bigger. Okay? And there's a lot of formalization we can do around that that allows us to know that. Yes, please.
How did you calculate the pairwise correlation for that particular?
Thank you so much. What a lovely question. So it turns out when you have more than two databases, you can use the third, fourth, fifth, and et cetera databases to, in some sense, take a look at the pairwise estimates. And from that, you can formalize, well, how does it look if I use only A and B? How does it look if I use B, A and C? How does it look if I do B and C? And by looking at all those angles, you can calculate those pairwise correlations. Okay. For people who have a little bit of statistics training, we do this in the classical way by building log linear models to predict cell counts. And one of those cell counts is this count of unobserved deaths. So that's how it's done classically. How it's done in a Bayesian context is so much more interesting and useful. And I will leave that to the discussion afterward in which Dr. Mitchell can attend us. Thanks, Dr. Mitchell. I'm wrapping up here. Okay, coming to the end. Look, there's only three ways to get to rigorous statistics. And if it's not rigorous, we have no business using it in human rights. People are depending on us. People are depending on us to be right. They're depending on us to be right so that we clarify history. We don't muddy it further with raw data, with naive raw data. They're depending on us to come up with arguments that can withstand adversarial criticism in court. That's very hard. And they're counting on us to advocate for the people who can't even be documented. If we can't name them, at least we should try to count them. But there's only three ways to get to statistics good enough for that to work. One is you could have a perfect census. That means you have all the data. You have all the data. If you have all the data, you can do anything you want. That hardly ever happens. But I said hardly ever. I didn't say never. Sometimes it happens. In Kosovo, we now have all the data for people killed between 1998 and 2000. In Bosnia, we have very, very close to all the data for the people killed between 1992 and 1995. In Northern Ireland, I think we have almost all the data on people killed in the Troubles. In Israel-Palestine, we have almost all the data on people killed in that conflict. But those are rare. Those are exceptions. Very rare. In some places, we have only the tiniest crumb of the information. Congo is probably the best case of that. In other places, and it seems to be more common projects I work on, that we have between a third and two-thirds of the data. And that's El Salvador. That's Peru. Peru is one-third. Colombia. Syria, Timor-Leste, those are places where we have this somewhat smaller fraction. So we don't have perfect censuses. Another way you can get rigorous statistics is by drawing a random sample from the population and interviewing them. Now, that's hard. We don't interview very many victims of homicide, for fairly obvious reasons. So it's actually pretty complicated to figure out what a random sample of homicides would be. How would we capture that? And as you get more deeply into that, there are epidemiological solutions which work for very specific ways, but when we're doing long retrospective projects, as we did in Timor-Leste, it turns out to be very challenging, and the models become quite complicated. It's hard to do, and there are many challenging technical issues. There have been a series of very well-publicized, very big errors in survey-based estimates of mortality in conflict. So there's a lot of moving parts. It's easy to get it very, very wrong. Finally, there's a third way, which is sometimes called a posterior modeling of the sampling process or post-stratification. And the method that I've been showing you today is one of a family of methods of that kind. Capture-recapture is the name of the method that I've been talking to you about with the circles and the M and the probability and multiplying up to N. It's called capture-recapture. There are others. And I want to be really clear that that is not the only way to do it. There are a couple other methods. The one that is most commonly used is called raking. There are probably others on top of that. I've explained and focused on capture-recapture because that's the one we do, but I don't want to give the impression that that's the only way to do it. But you do have to do one of these three things. If you're not doing one of these three things, if instead a data set has come to you and you've been like, well, I think it's probably a pretty good database, and I think it's reliable, I think it's trustworthy, I like the people who made it, they don't seem biased to me. Okay, well, those are not the right questions, right? I mean, the question is not whether or not the people who did it are politically unbiased. I actually prefer databases from groups that are politically biased. Why? Because they fill a niche. They go out and they really know their community because they're really focused on it and they'll bring us data. If there's another group that's biased in some other way, now we've got some real traction. Okay? So political bias, not a problem. Lies are a problem. There's ways to work with that, actually. But you have to do one of these three things. You have to do a census, a random sample, or posterior modeling. Because if you don't, here's what happens. You think you've got a trend that you found in your database. And what you're assuming by looking only at the raw data, sometimes people who use raw data say, well, I don't want to make assumptions. Well, no. If you're going to interpret that trend as meaningful in some way, what you are actually assuming is that the proportion of the world that you captured in the first point is exactly the same as the proportion of the world you captured in the second point, which is exactly the same as the proportion of the world you captured in the third point, and so forth. You are assuming that the capture probability or the coverage rate is identical, is uniform across all the points that you're going to draw on your graph. And when you say it like that, people are like, well, I know that's not true. Well, if it's not true, then the graph is actually just telling you about the reporting process. It's not telling you about the underlying violence that you think you're measuring. And that's a big problem. And the reason it's such a big problem, and the reason I'm going to keep thumping on the table on this stuff, is because we have to be right. Okay? There are enormous things at stake here. Okay? And I use this slide because this story is the one that comes back to me so often when I think about how important it is to be right. This man's name is Edgar Fernando Garcia, or was. And he was a student and labor organizer in Guatemala in the 1970s and early 1980s. In February of 1984, he left his office and didn't come home. Some people reported later that they saw men in civilian clothes put him in a car, an unmarked civilian car, and drive away. But that was about all we knew. So, and we knew even that little bit because his wife spent her life trying to find the information about what had happened to her husband. She did every kind of legal appeal available in Guatemala to get information from the government. They were like, denies. But in 2006, the historical archives of the National Police became available. And in the archives, there were documents which indicated pretty clearly that Mr. Garcia had been captured by the police in a specific campaign. And in the argument for that trial of these two men, they said, well, you know, hang on, we're just following orders. And the judge said, okay, guilty. That's not a defense. But if you're just following orders, she said to the prosecutor, you should go prosecute their boss, Colonel Hector Bol de la Cruz. Well, the thing was, the documents used to show that Mr. Garcia had been disappeared by the police had a lot of flaws. There were a lot of issues with those documents. Some were missing dates. Some were missing the stamps that the documents in the archives have showing that the document had physically, as a piece of paper, passed through different offices. Others were torn. Others were water-stained. So one of the questions the defense raised is, how can you trust these documents? They've gone through and found the crappiest, most illegible documents from the archive. These documents are trash. We showed through statistical analysis, by sampling documents from throughout the archive, that in fact the flaws in the documents used in this case were exactly consistent with the statistical pattern of flaws found in all the documents in the archive. We showed further that the pattern of documents used in the case was completely consistent with the larger pattern of bureaucratic flow of documents through the police archive itself, through the police bureaucracy. We showed that this was a completely standard bureaucratic operation. And that was one piece of evidence used to convict Colonel Bolt de la Cruz of the disappearance of Mr. Garcia. This matters. This stuff matters, and it matters that we're right because of the victims. This woman here is that little girl in her mother's arms up there, celebrating the conviction of her father's murderers. I think we have a duty to the victims to be right. And that means that we have to bring to bear on each of our technical areas the best science and technology that is available to us. And so I hope you are convinced that we should not use raw data, but rather we should hire statisticians when it is time to make a really important argument. Thank you very much.
If anyone needs to refuel thinking about all this algebra, please go ahead. But we're going to go ahead and use this mic in the center here. And I encourage you to come to the mic, ask your question. We have the room for about an hour, so we can go as long as we need in that time. Please go ahead. Don't be shy.
I'll start us off. Hey, Patrick. Yeah, that was wonderful. You had the X and Y axis graph, and you had a list of sources. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about the different sources. I'm also curious whether or not crowdsourcing is an interesting thing for you. I mean, I know you've had a debate with Ushahidi about that a little bit. So truth commissions, UN investigations. Oh, crowdsourcing is up there, okay.
Oh, yeah. And yeah. You remember when I said that big data amplifies selection bias?
Yeah.
That's what I was talking about. Yeah, that's really the most severe version of this, actually.
Well, I'd be curious to know if you think, is there a couple different questions. One is about what, you know, a little bit of a kind of a ranking of different kinds of sources for the purposes of your work. You know, do you find NGO documentation to be really good? I mean, what are the kinds of ranking you would do for the work that you're doing? But then there's a whole separate area of work which has to do with narrative, testimony, trying to get a whole, I mean, you know, stuff that isn't necessarily about the same kind of work that you're doing, which is what some of these are trying to do. And then a separate question is about crowdsourcing. Is there a role for crowdsourcing in this? Is there a way to do any kind of verification around crowdsourced data that comes to you? Is there something there that's interesting in the future, not as well as a critique of what's going on with crowdsourcing there?
So crowdsourcing is the kind of principal case of the problem of amplifying selection bias. And for statistical purposes, no, I don't think it's fixable. Okay? But it's no worse, in some sense, than these other sources are in terms of producing a list of victims. The data that I'm looking for is a list of victims. So if the crowdsourcing project is going to text in via SMS the names and maybe through the timestamp, we have to assume the dates and locations of the deaths, or if we're going to harvest that kind of information from YouTube videos, for example, another kind of crowdsourcing, that's fine. I mean, that's going to create a list that, for me, is the same kind of input as these other lists. Because what I'm looking for in data is just a list. So I know that for people who are interested in case analysis, we have an elaborate kind of discussion around corroboration, around verification, around the richness of the case. But I'm looking for a couple of names, a date, and a location. So the only thing that I'm worried about in data is that somebody's just made it up. completely made it up. And in as much as I can figure out that it's not made up, that data source is fine with me, and I'm delighted to use it. Okay? So I think all of these are really great sources as inputs to a process by which we adjust for what we don't know. None of them is adequate as a source by itself. Okay? And that's the key thing. And my critique of Ushahidi is that they just flow those texts into dots of variable sizes on maps. And the inference that we are to draw from those maps is that this dot is big and this dot is small. And there's no dot at all over here. Well, maybe that's because everyone over here knew about Ushahidi and the people over here didn't know about Ushahidi. Maybe it's because the people over here are texting to some other service and they don't like Ushahidi. Maybe it's because. And once you start the maybe it's because path, yeah, you're kind of done. You know, there's no way we are going to get back to a rigorous statistical analysis because we're stuck speculating about maybe it's because. So we need some sort of rigorous process, and by rigorous I mean some kind of math that takes us from a series of inputs to an estimate. And there are, as I said, there are a variety of approaches. I've presented one tonight. I always like NGO documentation, but that's more about my heart than about my work. It's just because I love the way NGOs engage with people. And I think that NGO documentation creates all sorts of secondary value, like narrative, like closure for a lot of the victims, like a sense that something can be done. So it's not that I prefer NGO documentation because I think it's statistically better, but because I think it produces a lot of other secondary value. And I worry in particular about crowdsourcing because I think it's so, it's not just easily misused, it's generally misused in the first instance by comparing dots on a map. And then we're stuck in this debate about, well, we have something, look, we have a map with dots on it. I'm like, well, it's not really reliable. We don't really know if any of that's true. In fact, everything we know suggests it's not true. You're like, but it's got dots and it's a map. And the conversation kind of dies there. And it has died there for years, as I think you know, which is why you set me up with that question. So, yeah, I think, is that all the?
Yeah.
Hi, thanks a lot. It's a fascinating presentation. Thank you. Very energetic, too. Really appreciated that. I'm Jesse. I'm from Global Youth Connect, and we run human rights programs in post-violence countries, including Bosnia and Rwanda. I was fascinated by your statistic about Bosnia. I'll take a look at that. I don't know about other people in the room, but I think it's pretty common that there's a big controversy about the data related to Rwanda, and I hadn't heard that in your list, and I was curious if you have done any reflection on that data. I know there's a lot of question about whether or not the government of Rwanda or other people who are saying that there were a million Tutsis killed are actually covering up many other deaths, or whether that counter-argument is actually hogwash. And the BBC came out with a documentary called The Untold Story, which brought out a lot of these statistics, and then Rwanda shut down the BBC again and, you know, said this is hogwash. So.
Right.
I'm just curious if you could point me in the right direction. I will look forward to reading and watching some of these things with your presentation in mind.
So two political scientists, Al Stamm and Christian Davenport, who were cited extensively in the BBC piece, you could read their work. The Rwandan government calls them Holocaust deniers. That seems like a misreading of their work to me. It seems like they're not denying Holocaust or genocide. They're saying that there was a very complicated pattern of killing of civilians by all the armed groups, but asymmetrically. So I'll leave it there. I'll leave you to look up. Al Stamm and Christian Davenport are their names. And if you Google Christian, you'll find that he and I have been co-authors many times. And so perhaps I have a little bit of connection to that work, but I haven't actually done any math with them or really looked at their data very much. So I can't answer much more than that.
Hi, my name is Peter Xavier. I'm a 1L at NYU. I come from the business tech world, and so I'm a bit dismayed, very dismayed to see or to hear about the lack of rigorous mathematical and statistical knowledge within human rights organizations. At least that's how it seems from the presentation. So I'm curious if you were to suggest ways for someone like myself to tech up in statistics, algebra. I took stats years ago, did just well enough to get through it. I don't pretend to be, you know, a professional in that field, but I do want to kind of build those skills. And so if you were looking at policy, law students, what would you suggest that they, or professionals, that they learn?
Well, one thing is they can come be our intern. And so I'll give you my card, okay?
I'm assuming these are unpaid internships.
Let me talk to my donor. That's one thing, but I think I am not critical of the human rights community for not having very much of this expertise. It makes a lot of sense to me, because the human rights community has largely been driven by lawyers, because it's primarily a legal field, and we've picked up a few other disciplines along the way. You know, we've gotten historians and archivists and forensic anthropologists and now satellite imagery analysts and journalists and psychologists, and you know, and now we're picking up statisticians. I don't think that this is a problem that is in any way unique to the human rights space. We see the craving for evidence-based or data-based argument throughout all of the world right now. Everybody is craving it. And I think that it's actually industry that is primarily to blame, because the criticisms that I'm raising here don't apply to most industry contexts. If you're Amazon, you know every single click that every one of your customers makes. You know every minute they spend on every single page of every single product they look at. You know which ones they buy, you know which ones they don't buy, etc. Every little piece of the data is available to you. And so your analytics can be as complicated and sophisticated as you want, and you'll be right. And that power has leaked out from industry and is affecting the rest of the world. Unfortunately, most of the rest of the world, we don't have perfect data. In most of the rest of the world, we have, in fact, really problematic data, very challenging data, even when it's produced by automated or semi-automated means, like crowdsourcing, which is produced by hundreds or thousands of people sending text messages into a central point. Okay? Furthermore, we've gotten very, very excited in the world about the notion of big data. Okay? We think that we all have in our heads somehow that the error of some kind of statistical calculation gets smaller the more data we use to make that calculation. Okay? And that isn't fundamentally wrong. Okay? At the base of statistics, we have the logic that if we chose the sample at random, well, we usually forget that part, but if we chose the sample at random, the larger the sample, the smaller the error. That's true. If we chose the sample at random, remember that part? We didn't ever choose any of the samples at random. And as a consequence, getting larger and larger and larger samples is amplifying the bias rather than ameliorating it, because we're getting better and better and better at covering the places that are visible and coverable, and we're not really getting any better at all in the places that aren't. And I'm asserting that, but I've shown three examples, and I can point you to some articles where we've written, you know, another six or eight examples. We have tons of examples of this now in the human rights context, but I think it's true across the social space. Across almost all social statistics, the kinds of analysis that are done on, statisticians call this, all this data, we call this convenience data, which does not mean it's convenient to collect, it means it's not randomly selected. And stuff that's not randomly selected, I think all has this kind of problem that it is produced in some way, and there's a reason it got produced, and there's a reason other information did not get produced. Okay? And those reasons very often correlated with what we're trying to figure out. So, not a unique problem to human rights by any means. It's just that's what gets me all head up.
So, I'm going to take moderator privilege and inject some gender balance to our question and answer. I wondered, following up on that question, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the kinds of barriers to getting greater understanding of your work. I mean, clearly there's math, but also I feel like we have two worlds operating in parallel. We have a narrative world, a qualitative world, a legal world, and we have the work that you're trying to do. So I think talking through a little bit of whether it's about honing the right questions that can be answered by what you do, or if there's some other angle we should be discussing, I wonder if you could sort of speak to that.
Well, certainly honing the questions we're asking is, if we want to build an integrated project in which we use information from lots of different fields. Let's kind of talk through what that would look like, right? So we're going to start, in a, it's going to be a big human rights project. Let's say it's a truth commission, or let's say it's a prosecution of a human rights case. We're going to start with lawyers, right? That's where it's going to start, because they're going to tell us what the legal framework is about why this is a human rights problem rather than some other kind of problem. We probably want to bring in other disciplines too, and we'll bring the historians in, but we don't ask the lawyers about the history, and we don't ask the historians about the legal framework. We have to figure out, okay, how does the historical context situate the legal framework? And then we'll bring the forensic anthropologists in. We don't ask them about the legal framework either. We say, hey, what's the cause of death that you can infer from the pattern of human remains that you exhume? So with each additional discipline, we have a challenge of figuring out what's the question this discipline can answer that substantiates the rest of the argument. And statistics is no different. I think that when in a large argument, if what we're doing with the statistics is simply trying to figure out the magnitude, we're not really using the statistics in a very intelligent way. Magnitude's not an especially interesting question, and you know, unless you're trying to get the media to write something about it. But other than that, if what you have is an analytic question, you need a comparison. If you're making an argument about genocide, for example, the question that you want to ask is, what is the mortality rate of the group that's the target of genocide, and what is the mortality rate of the group that you think is not the target of genocide? Those rates should be really different, because if they're not, the statistics do not substantiate the argument that there is genocide. That doesn't mean there wasn't. It just means the statistics aren't going in that direction, and there may be good reasons for that, but that's something to think about. But if there is a really big differential, then you can conclude that the statistical argument is consistent with the hypothesis that there was genocide. And that was, in a nutshell, the argument that I presented in the prosecution of General Jose Efrain Reyes Montt in Guatemala for genocide in 2013. It's a giant differential in the mortality rates between the indigenous community and the non-indigenous community. In fact, if you were an indigenous person, the probability that you were killed by the army was 8 times greater than the probability that your non-indigenous neighbor was killed by the army in the same period in the same 3 counties where the case focused. So that's differential, that's the comparison, and that's the kind of argument that we should be looking for in to use statistics in a larger human rights project. Like, what is the trend? What is the pattern? What is the comparison? What is the kind of things that we can look at next to each other? I'm getting more and more interested as we get deeper and deeper in our work on Syria, to think about these patterns over time that relate to the movement of the conflict across the country. As areas change control, as they've been doing constantly for the last 4 years, how do the killing rates change? Okay? And that's especially interesting because the denominators here are getting smaller and smaller. People are leaving. People are moving out. Millions and millions of people have left Syria. And the number, the raw number of people being killed continues to be very, very high. So, in fact, the rates are skyrocketing, if you think about it in proportional terms. So this is very interesting, and I think that what you need to bring in this contextual knowledge to be able to frame the question appropriately. Let me deliberately misunderstand the second part of your question, if I may, and say, how can we do this better? And I think it's by having more statisticians working in this field. That's hard because, first of all, it's really hard because there's this giant sucking power of money that pulls statisticians into the private sector. And the human rights community has a really hard time competing with that. So that's one of the big challenges. The other challenge is that we actually do some fairly specific kinds of statistics, and statisticians are one statistician is different from another as a contract lawyer is from someone who prosecutes war crimes, right? So it's a big field, and there's a lot of different kinds of things people do. Our vision in the Human Rights Data Analysis Group for the future is to bring in people who have ideally some graduate level preparation in math and statistics and programming, and to teach them to become first-rate analysts and programmers so that they can process data and make estimates in what we think is a really responsible way to support the human rights community, and then spin them out. We don't intend to retain them. We don't want to be the locus of this work, but rather we want to be a training network so that after we've worked with people who have been 1Ls and then interns with us for some time, They go and work in other human rights projects, in international NGOs, in donors, in UN missions, in tribunals, in whatever that project is, so that there's an in-house voice. My experience is that it's way easier for people to listen to an in-house statistician than it is to get advice from someone outside. So that's really the model that I think is going to work.
Hi, Mark Latinero, Data and Society Research Institute. Patrick, great presentation. I really appreciate your last comment on that we need to be right. I also want to ask kind of how right we actually need to be. And what I mean by that is, how right do we need to be in terms of a situation like real-time decision-making on a current human rights abuse? For instance, the crowdsourcing, it could be the purpose of crowdsourcing is not to estimate all the acts of abuse or killing or homicide in an area. It could just be to report even one incident that someone with operational capacity is going to go to that incident and act in real time. And so maybe you can shed some light on the decision-making process as we move from sort of retrospective human rights abuses to sort of towards the real time.
Sure, I think that's a really good question, and I appreciate it, Mark. Let me start off by saying, let me go back to the slide that we were looking at before with the list of all the different kinds of information, or not all, but many kinds of information about human rights violence that I've looked at over the years. And there's a lot of different kinds of data there. All of that data is interesting if our job is case analysis. If what we want to know is more about the existence of a case, oh my gosh, there's a killing here, we need to deal, or we want to learn more about the case, we can use any information we like. We don't have a concern about representativity, which in one word is fundamentally the concern I'm raising here. We don't have the concern. We have concern about existence, the existence of knowledge about that specific thing. So if what we want to know is there a homicide? Any of these methods will get us there. Okay? If what we want to know is, where's the hot spot of homicides where we deploy resources? All of these will fail egregiously. That is a terrible use of these techniques. And I think that crowdsourcing has been very, very problematic in this real-time decision process that you proposed. And I'd be happy to, maybe afterwards we can talk through a couple of examples of cases where I think that's been very, very bad. But I'll just flag first off Haiti. That was a very, very problematic use. I can talk through some of our analysis on that if you'd like later. But if you're looking for case data, have at it. Absolutely. Use everything you can get.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your talk. It's really fascinating. I am Enrico Bertini. I am an assistant professor from NYU, Polytechnic School of Engineering. I don't know much about human rights, but I work with Meg, who you know, and we are trying to work together on some of these things. I have a question, maybe a little bit provoking, I don't know. So I totally agree with you that there is a problem when you communicate information using only exclusively raw data, and raw data is clearly biased, right? But maybe there is another side of the coin. So whenever you have an estimate, you also have uncertainty on this estimate. And people don't understand bias very well, I guess people don't understand uncertainty very well. And I'm just curious to hear from you what's your opinion on that.
It's a gigantic problem. You're totally right. This is huge. Estimates do have uncertainty. So what that means is that if you think about when you've seen a survey result, like a public opinion survey, and someone says, well, 40% of people agree with this policy, and there's a margin of error of plus or minus 3%. Okay? What's being said there is that if we were to repeat the data collection 100 times, then in 95% of those recollections, the estimate of people who agree with this policy would fall between 37 and 43%. Well, that's a little cumbersome, and it's really hard to get your head around. Fortunately, the new statistical approaches allow us to make much, much better statements of uncertainty. And we can talk about that a little bit. Our new round of estimates are all fully Bayesian. So we've made that move now. But this is, I think, our last ever frequentist set of estimates. And so we present our graphs as much as we can with error whiskers on them. And then we talk in the narrative about what the error means, okay, around the estimate. Now, is that adequate? It's hard to say. In other contexts, I don't think that caveats are useful. So when we sometimes say, but isn't it true that all we have to do to get out of all this, I agree with you, Patrick, everything you've said is certainly the case, but what if we just say that these are the statistics according to testimonies given to the Truth Commission? Well, that's what I did for all through the 90s. All of our statistical arguments say have that caveat. But what we found is that nobody remembers that caveat later, even us.
Yeah.
Okay. And I saw a couple weeks ago a presentation by a big shot big data guy who said the same thing at the beginning of his talk, but by the end of his talk, it was a 10-minute talk, by the end of his talk, he was generalizing from his conclusion to the whole world.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody can remember those caveats, so the caveats don't work at all. So I'm not actually sure if my interpretation of error works all that well, because I don't know that people carry it forward either. But by saying it's an estimate, we kind of constantly evoke the importance of the measurement of uncertainty. For people who are not full-on stats geeks here, many statisticians consider statistics to be the study of uncertainty. Okay? That's how many statisticians understand our job. Because anyone can come up with an estimate. The rigorous part is putting the error bounds around it. The rigorous mathematical part that requires all this elaborate mathematics is saying how uncertain that estimate is. And some of these estimates are very uncertain. And the uncertainty may be asymmetric. And these are very asymmetric kinds of uncertainty. We're much less certain about how high the estimate might be than how low it is. We know it's almost certainly not lower than that, but wow, it could be way up there. You can see how asymmetric they are. That's typical in this kind of statistical approach. So big problem. Don't know that I have great approaches. Now that we're doing Bayesian stuff, we have a lot more capacity to express uncertainty in graphical form, because posterior distribution is much easier to represent.
My name is Ilana Weiser. I'm from the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, most of your talk is focused on killings, murders, homicides, very black and white. Someone's either dead or they're not dead. Mm-hmm. At CPJ, we track attacks, imprisonments, killings of journalists, but we're very focused on the motivation.
Right.
So we might know mm-hmm. that someone is killed, but what we're trying to determine is, were they killed specifically because of their journalistic work, or were they just in the wrong place in the wrong time in Honduras? And I wonder if you can address that kind of subjective analysis at all, its unique problems, or how it fits into...
Well, it's not unique. Okay. You'll notice I didn't say anything about, when I was talking about police homicides, I didn't say, these are unjustified, or these are justified. These are according to each department's procedures, or they're not. I when we look at Syria, I didn't say, these are combatants, these are civilians. I didn't say that. And the reason is that all of those kinds of determinations are very difficult to make at scale. You can make them for each case, and maybe even we could get what a statistician would call inter-rater reliability. We get agreement among five or six people who independently decide on each case, reading the available material, whether or not this is an A or a B case, whether or not it's killed because he's a journalist or killed because for some other reason, you know, someone wants to steal his car. That even if we got that high level of intersubjective agreement, it's not clear that that agreement is the same as the agreement we would get in Guatemala or in Nigeria or in South Africa. I mean, it's too complicated. And when we come to legal determinations about someone's civilian or combatant status, for example, no way do I believe that those decisions made hundreds of thousands at a time are reliable and consistent across that whole process. So we stick to things that are countable precisely because we want to be able to make statements that we can defend. Even though those statements are not as interesting or as useful as statements would be if we could qualify them with, these are people killed because they were journalists. That would be a much more interesting and useful statement, but we don't feel comfortable making it. It's just too hard, and it's too mushy.
Can I ask a follow-up
question? Sure.
So one of the things that we try to do at CPJ is focus on emblematic cases, you know, and push for example, prosecutions and the emblematic murder of Anna Politkovskaya in Russia, that kind of thing. Do you
absolutely.
Any thoughts?
That's great. Right.
It's a safe thing to do, I guess. To just
absolutely
to
safe. And look, I want nothing I've said tonight to be construed as a criticism of qualitative reasoning. I think that qualitative reasoning gets us out of many of these traps because we rest the legitimacy of our conclusion on the reputation of the researcher. we say, oh, wow, this is a report from someone that I think really knows a ton about this field. She knows the economic history. She knows the military history. She knows all these different people involved. She knows what's going on here, so she can paper over the people she didn't talk to with judgment, with knowledge that comes from other contextual areas. Yeah, contextual knowledge, not so easy to include in statistics. And before very recently, we couldn't include it at all. Now we can include it in tiny little, very, very specific, narrow ways. But even so, not really. That's not really the job of statistics to do. So I think that qualitative research is what I advocate in place of this. We need much more qualitative research that is self-consciously qualitative and less bad statistics. Bad statistics are worse than no statistics. And that's something we have to convince even the Security Council that thinks it can create statistics by resolution.
Hi, I'm Minky Worden from Human Rights Watch, and not a statsy or whatever it was that you just said. But we at Human Rights Watch have been longtime believers in your message, and I think you have an important point that is being heard. But let me ask you on the other side, with everything that, with all of the caveats and cautions and the scare that you put into human rights groups who feel the urgent need for a graphic of some kind to make their human rights report sail out into the world and find a home on the front pages of the world's newspapers, how can you empower people to use statistics without fear? And what tools are you and HRDAG, or whatever your acronym is, what tools are you bringing to the table to help us do what we need to do better?
I'm not really bringing tools in a software or mathematical sense, but what we're bringing is people that we can place in your organizations to do it with you, which we've done for you. So.
But how do we clone you? How do we clone you? There need to be.
We're working on it. I mean, we bring in interns, we train people, and then we want to spin them out. That's what I think the answer is. The answer is not mechanical. It is not the statistics is not technology. This is science is not technology. These are often conflated. They are completely different. You cannot build a piece of technology that will do this in a trivial way so that people can just pour the data in and get an answer. That's not going to happen. And if people promise it to you, the name for what they're offering is snake oil. Okay? And they may not know that themselves, but that's very, very dangerous. And I just will put in this, I'm concerned about the entire field that's called data science now, because it strikes me that data science is a field of very skillful programmers who are not at all worried about probability. It is a field that never uses the word sampling. And if you don't know how the data was sampled from the population, your visualizations, no matter how beautiful, are misleading. So I give these scares. The tool I offer is, hey, send me someone with some basic programming math and statistics preparation, and Megan and Christiane and I will train her or him into a first-rate analyst for you.
Thank you.
I mean, aren't you suggesting organizational behavior change? Like,
yes.
Really what you're saying is that there is a choice to be made in the allocation of scarce resources in a human rights organization to pay for a statistician and not another lawyer.
Yeah.
Either that or don't use statistics. Right? I mean, that's the choice. I mean, listen, here's a metaphor, people. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to block. Here's a metaphor, okay? Let's say that in your village you find a mass grave. Do you say, hey, I'm going to call all my friends to come over with shovels and we're just going to dig it all up? We'll get it done in an afternoon. No, you'd call the forensic anthropologists, right? You'd call the people who studied how you understand the signs of violence on human remains in order to exhume the data in a way that preserves its evidentiary value. If you want to submit a case to your country's Supreme Court, you don't say to yourself, you know, my daughter's a really good writer. You know, and she's just finished eighth grade and she can write like crazy. So I'm just going to have her write it all up. No, you hire a lawyer. You hire the best lawyer you can find. Why do we think statistics is easier somehow or more mechanical than forensic anthropology or the law? Why do we think that? Is it because statistics is so trivially easy? I don't think so. So it's not. If groups want to do statistics, they've got to hire statisticians, they've got to hire really serious ones. And ideally, serious statisticians that are very, very sensitive to exactly the kinds of problems that we have in human rights data.
I think it's a very interesting presentation, and the work you do is very good in the human rights field. Now, my interest is a little bit, how do we, first, people make their decisions based upon evolutionary biology, psychology, emotion, and too many people in this country reject science outright, and many more want to cherry pick science to favor whatever views they favor already. So how do we help convince people what you're doing is good for what they're doing? And you know, as far as the scope of social problems we have, whether it's denial of global warming or what's going on in the world, or my comment earlier about the police, just police alone. Until you are the victim of police misconduct, the police are there to protect you, and you fall for their union's propaganda about how dangerous it is and all the cops that are killed by violent felons. But it seems to me what we need, and that also we have the ability in this country with freedom of information laws, and now everybody has an iPhone. So there's the data that's available, at least to the NSA. How do we convince or look at the data to see, you know, how many people are killed by cops, how many people threaten the cops and kill the cops, and give them information where they can say, you know what, it looks like cops are acting in general, it's too many homicides vis-a-vis what's going on. So I guess my point is, how do you sell what you're doing to the population and maybe get the population to see there's value in what you're doing to all sorts of different things, police misconduct being one?
I'm a simple country statistician. I don't know. I mean, we very self-consciously position ourselves as not advocates, and I'm just not really very good at advocacy. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to advocate on behalf of science. I would leave that to my very competent friends at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I think they do a really good job. Maybe not good enough, but I think they labor mightily in this area. I teach a little kids' summer camp for my friends' kids where we do little scientific experiments that lead to statistical understandings for 9-year-olds, it's a blast. And what I find is when we do these little experiments, the kids are kind of sold on the scientific method. And so I think good scientific training is really super valuable, but I don't know how to scale that to, you know, hundreds of millions of people. I know how to do it, you know, for 12 kids or something. Honestly, I'm sorry, have you just...
Let me clarify. People are more afraid of a snake or a spider than of a car. Although scientifically or statistically, you're much greater at risk of dying in an automobile accident than from a spider or a snake. Yeah. So how do we, as people, or you, people who are into numbers, help convince people you got to be worried about the car, right, not the snake?
Yeah, people are way more worried about terrorists than they are about police, for example. And the difference is about a factor of 10 in your probability of being killed. So. I don't have an answer to that either. I'm really sorry. I'm just doing this thing, man. You're asking for a lot. This is what I got. That's it. Sorry. It's a really important question. I just don't know the answer.
I am the data sciences student at Columbia University.
Right on. Tell me about your probability training.
Quite a bit, actually. I can't say I did very well in the class, but it is at least 30.
You're worrying about sampling a lot?
Very much so.
Sampling bias?
Yes.
Make estimates and adjust the data before you do a visualization?
I can't speak specifically to the techniques. I've only done the introductory course so far, but there's two more courses to go.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. If only they did that at Cal.
My question is, do you see any application of machine learning techniques to any of the work that you do?
Yeah, tons. We do a lot of machine learning, but I have all kinds of worries about it too. My worries about machine learning, so when we do that M in the middle, If we have 350,000 records, that's primarily a machine learning problem. So deduplication, database deduplication is our primary application in machine learning. So I do a lot of programming in that. I like machine learning a lot. I'm really, really worried about it in a lot of spaces, in particular around the use of machine learning for policing, because the models we're training with data that is information known to the police. So what we're doing is training the models to do exactly what the police did in the last round, which isn't all that useful, but isn't all that harmful by itself. The problem is that we think we're predicting crime. We're doing no such thing. We're predicting policing in a very literal way, because it's a circular process by which crime known to police is used to train the data, train the models, which then tell the police what to do, so police go and do what the model says. And by the way, when they look at the model, they're like, hey, that's great, that's just what we're going to do. Like, that's a good thing. And then, circularity. So I'm delighted to hear that there's a probability in that. I assure you that is not what most data science programs do. Yeah, so, but you got a good one. Yay, alma mater, I went to Columbia.
Hi, my name is Morris. I'm actually also from Human Rights Watch. And I have a bit of a technical question. You mentioned that one of your biggest problems is lies in your list.
Right.
Is there a way you normalize that through statistical analysis, or do you have to go through manually to sort that kind of thing out?
Well, I wouldn't know a lie from a truth.
Okay.
Right? I mean, Muhammad A, Muhammad B, both killed in Hama in December 2013. Maybe one's a lie, maybe one's not. I don't know. What I do know is that if I'm asking a substantive question, like, was there a giant rise in killings in January 2013 in Hama, that what I can do is make different kinds of assumptions about the structure and pattern of those lies and delete the records systematically and reestimate and thereby simulate the impact of the lies. What if I drop 2,000 records from data source one and I only drop the records that only appear in data source one? Right? So they're like this. They're like the left side of the circle there. They only appear in data source one, but not in data source two. And I say, well, I think data source one may be telling us porcupines. So we just drop a whole lot of records from that, and we see, does that change the output in a way that is substantively meaningful? Does that give us a different answer? If it does, then we conclude that our result is sensitive to the possibility that there are a lot of lies in data source one. We have a very specific conclusion. Now, we still don't know if there are lies or not in data source one. We're going to have to rely on some external source of information to figure out what the rate of lies might be. All data has some kind of lies in it. Most of them are inadvertent. Most of them are errors, not lies. But errors and lies for us are kind of the same thing. If we report a man is dead in the conflict, but really he died when a building fell on him, and or he had a heart attack, well, maybe he's not really dead in the conflict, but he's in our list. So what's the impact of his presence on our result? Another way to think about that is, what if he's not dead at all? He's actually in a refugee camp in Lebanon. But everybody thought he was dead, and they didn't dig up the building because they were running away from more fighting. Okay, totally reasonable, but actually he got out and he's in Lebanon. Well, it turns out one of the things that I so admire about these amazing, amazing human rights groups in Syria is that they keep correcting these databases. There's an elaborate and very, very, very detailed process of revision. And we know this because we keep getting updates from them, and the data keeps changing. So we're like, that record's gone now. Where'd it go? And we now know that they're editing some out, they're changing some of the fields, and so there's this constant churn of records, which is exactly what we would hope for if the groups are updating their databases as they get new information. So I think the Syrian groups are absolutely terrific on this score.
Do you think that's unique to human rights-related data, that there's such an inaccuracy in a lot of the collection and that it has to be updated that much, as opposed to other more normal data?
Sure. I mean, you're collecting data in the middle of a conflict. Bombs are falling. You're hungry. You don't have so much access to the area. Maybe the people who give you the report don't know the person who they're reporting about very well. There's plenty of reasons, plenty of completely legitimate reasons that the information would be inaccurate on the first draft and get better over time as people continue researching it. Yeah, there's every reason in the world. I think maybe particularly for human rights data, but I can imagine other contexts, humanitarian catastrophes, for example, where your first draft of information is often pretty vague.
Hi, my name is Amelia Wolf with the Council on Foreign Relations. And I work mostly on conflict prevention, which I know is kind of a touchy topic with statistics. And it seems like this analysis would be useful for post-conflict or holding people accountable also, is there any applicability, or might there be in the future, for prevention or, I know, forecasting or anything like that?
There are some interesting forecasting projects. Okay, yeah, the Correlates of War project, you probably know. Yeah, I know Phil Trout. You know, we're on panels together and stuff. And look, forecasting is an interesting and hard problem, but it's also in curious ways. And Phil has it's Phil who's convinced me of this. It's actually easier than estimating magnitudes. Here's why: when you're doing a forecast, you've got a lot of different variables at play, right? You're going to say we're going to predict the presence or absence of conflict in all the countries in the world or in some subset of countries next year. And the way we're going to do that is we know whether or not there was, you know, we have a yes or no on conflict in all those countries for some large number of past years. Okay? So that's the dependent variable. In statistics logic, we're predicting the presence or absence of conflict. And it turns out you do need to know that variable exactly. You need to know correctly and completely and exactly whether or not there was conflict, this whatever or whatever your dependent variable is, in order to make forecasts that aren't completely garbage. However, you have a lot of other variables in the model that are the things you're going to use to make the prediction. You know, the change in GDP from last year, the unemployment rate, the presence or absence of conflicts in neighboring regions, the presence of some kind of ideological or religious extremism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to have a whole set of these variables. And I know that the Correlates of War people have gone through literally hundreds of variables, fishing to find the ones that best predict the outcome, the dependent variable. Turns out, doesn't matter how bad the independent variables are. The independent variables can be completely crap. They can be totally biased. They can be actually meaningless or uninterpretable. It doesn't matter. If they help you make a good prediction, you're good to go. Okay? Now, that's really, really interesting to me. The second observation I would make about conflict forecasting is that it's not actually very good. Right? The best models really only can predict the cases that are fairly obvious. And the obvious case is no conflict next year, because no matter what subset of countries you look at, the overwhelming majority of them are going to have no conflict in the subsequent period. So your prediction, if you just say no conflict, you're right like 80% of the time, right? That's not a very interesting model, but you get a really, really impressive score having no independent variables, right? So if you add a few independent variables, you can get a little better, but honestly, the best models don't do that much better from obvious, in my experience. You know, we don't really know how this stuff works. These guys have proclaimed victory, and Phil and I kind of fought about this at a conference in Wisconsin last November. They're like, we got it. Look at this. We can account for like 83% of the variability in conflict next year. And I'm like, yeah, because 80% of it's no. You know, it's like it was easy, right? You got all the easy cases, and so you bulked up your success rate. But you can't get past that threshold. You're stuck there. And I think you're stuck there because it's contextual. It's not structural. I just don't believe it. So I don't really believe that we're ever going to get early warning or conflict prediction. I just think, you know, we've got, 20 years of work on this stuff now, and we're really not doing any better than we did, like, after the first 2 years. So, dead in the water.
Hi, my name's Ernie Drucker. I'm a public health epidemiologist that works in criminal justice now in the anthropology department at John Jay College down the river. And one of the things we've been very concerned about is the police killings. The students are thinking about this, faculty, average person thinking about it. And you ran very casually before through a set of numbers when I asked you about the number of police killings in the United States in a year. And if you go to any of you go to Google and ask that question, the first 10 hits you'll get will give you 3 or 4 different estimates.
Of police numbers?
Of how many police killings were there. Different sources, and they all seem to be authoritative. Some of them are even governmental,
right.
Ranging from 456 to 1,104,
right.
For 2013 or 14, I forgot the year. That's a pretty big discrepancy, almost 2.5 times as big.
Sure.
And 1,000 means it means 20 every week. And we've had 8 of these stories that have dominated the news in the country for the last year. And correctly so, and the pictures on the newspaper of that windshield with all the bullets in it.
Right.
And imagine what the pictures of victims look like if they were exhibited, which they should be, like Emmett Till's was. Because when you realize the level of the violence, you know, you have violence in the title of your session here. And that's what a lot of this is about. It's the level of violence that people aren't used to thinking about. So when you say you have a method of estimating the unknown portion of that denominator of police killings, And I mean, the big lesson, I taught epidemiology at Columbia, and it's about the denominator. That's what public health is about. What is that end? What is that parent population of the real number of people? You know, within 10 or 20% is good enough for most purposes of policy. But when you take that number up to 19,000, possibly for 5 years, that was the estimate you had in your text there.
No. 10,000 over 8 years.
It's 8 years, okay.
Yeah, it's 8 years.
But then, you know, you picked up on the fact that 30% of the possible cases of that weren't surveilled. So now they are. When you add those deaths in, you add another 30% on. And that figure of having 30% of all homicides of someone, not by someone you know, by strangers, that take the remainder, and 30% of those might, you know, possibly be due to police action, that blows my mind. And that's a very, very powerful fact, idea, that what you talked about, not just being a humble country statistician, but you're sitting on a very hot piece of information there that is very hard to refute, actually, once you walk through it the way you do, and the facts support it without having to know the details. And public health as a science is based on not the best data in the world, but having so much of it, you can overcome its inadequacies and get the big picture. And the big picture here is the level of violence being perpetrated by police on black men in the United States, such that in every concentrated poor black population, 95% of those men have been in prison at some point. D.C., Washington, D.C., the six areas of New York City that are filled with prisons here. So everyone knows about this in those communities, and they know the level of prevalence, if you will, of violence, police violence on them. Stop and Frisk showed that very clearly, even though it made the epidemiologists crazy because it was, you know, something was tiny and getting smaller all the time, and therefore people want to say, oh, that means it's going away. No, it's being sampled differently. It's all sampling.
Right.
Anyway, I think you have a very powerful tool there from a human rights point of view that, now, like that's in your name, in your organization's name, but to use that for advocacy is an important job that you're welcome to participate in. And I know you do. It doesn't cheapen your findings or your methods. It really doesn't.
Pardon?
I'm saying to take the evidence that you uncover of a gross underestimation of the level of police violence in this country is the answer to the. What's the retort of the police? Oh, well, you look, there are many, many more killings of black men by other black men than there are by police.
I don't know what they're going to say.
Well, it's lies and statistics. You know the book. So I think there's a lot of room. You know, I think you can ask for more of the lay audience about understanding scale, for example. This is five every week we're talking about. And you see what happens with eight of those cases in the paper. More. So I just wanted to be encouraging around
that word.
The technical part is very important, and it's very much appreciated.
Our goal is to have other groups that are advocacy groups use this. So we work with, I've spent the week in New York meeting with my advocacy partners, among my other meetings, explaining a lot of this stuff to them and saying, hey, why don't you use this in your work? Because you're good at it. You've got an audience. You know how to speak to that audience. You know how to do this. I don't. And honestly, I don't have time and even really interest in learning those skills. I want to do more machine learning. I want to do more statistics. I want to learn how to build really cool Bayesian models from Shira. You know, I have a lot of things I want to do, and I can't do that. We are three full-time professionals in my group. That's it. Okay? So we are really, really saturated, and I totally appreciate how important this stuff is. That's why we're doing it. But I can't do the other pieces. So we want to hand it off. We don't want to compete with our partners. We want to support them. We often say, in our best case, we're a footnote in somebody's report. But we're a damn good footnote. And it's a footnote that's right. It's going to stick. They're never going to be discredited on that footnote. But we want to be a footnote in somebody else's report.
You can be a headline.
I think we can take one more question. Meg, were you on the list?
Hi. I'm just a 9-year-old who never went to your camp. So if I want to say, hey, you know, to teach all the people, you know, to know about statistics and how interesting it, do you have some kind of resource that we could go to? That's the first one. You know, to make statistics more interesting instead of like big textbooks and, you know, professor and whatnot, right? And then the second question is that how do we use statisticians? You know, how do we use your professional so we could, you know, have, instead of like, you know, whatever say is correct, we could, you know, be able to, you know, maximize the resource and the time and without getting hogwashed or without, you know, going to barking up the wrong trees and so on like that. So I would like to have some kind of resources that as laymen that like we do, you know, or general public to say, hey, statistic is cool. Second is, hey, you a statistician, I know how to use you and I know, you know, ask you the right questions or whatnot.
Well, in this, I'm very fortunate to be a member of the American Statistical Association that does a huge amount of work specifically on those two questions, on the education of lay people around statistical questions and on how can you learn more about statistics and get contact with a statistician for a nonprofit project in particular. There's a network called Statisticians Without Borders that will do will engage with nonprofit projects on a voluntary basis to do deep statistical thinking about specific problems, not specific to human rights, specific to the range of issues that affect human well-being. So those are the two key answers. If you want more, if you want some links into that, you could just go to their website, amstat.org, amstat.org, and look for educational materials. They've got tons there. And there's an enormous effort at the American Statistical Association to do more outreach to non-statisticians and explain how cool statistics are.
Thank you.
Thanks everybody very much for coming.